This is a production of Cornell University.
So it looks like it is 12:15 now. I'm going to call this meeting to order. I believe Michelle is going to do roll call. I see that she's on right now. So I'm going to turn the floor over to Michelle to do roll call.
Alrighty, Susan Berry. Joseph.
I'm sorry, this is Sue, I'm here. I couldn't unmute.
Thank you, Susan. And Joseph, to see you are here. Marin.
Hi.
Thank you. Jackie.
I don't see her in the room.
Okay. Jamie.
Here.
Hey. Brenda. Brenda Fisher. Brent Fortenberry.
Here.
Thank you. Brian Goodell is here. Andrea.
Yep, I'm here.
Great. Deborah Howell. Let's admit.
I don't see Deborah.
Okay. Emily Ivory. Rigel Lochner.
Here.
Christine.
I'm here.
Virginia McCauley. Jen Michael.
Here.
I see. Ashley Miller.
Present.
Ellen Miller. I see you. Mary Newhart.
Here.
You're here. Michelle Podolek.
Here.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did a great job. It's Podolek.
Podolek, thank you. Nasser?
Hello, Nasser here.
Nasser, thank you. Kate, here. Kit?
Here. I'm here. I don't know if you saw.
Laura Taylor. Jessica Townley. Catelyn Wilcox. Jessica Withers. Yes. And Lisa Zacharias.
Yep, I'm here.
Great. All right. And I see Wendy, let me admit her, and we're all set.
And Jackie is in the room as well.
Okay, great.
Thank you, Michelle, for roll call. So I see some new faces here today. I just want to go over some sort of order of business and then also talk about how we all participate in this online meeting, since it's not typical to the normal EA meetings that we have. If you would like to be recognized to speak, please use the hand raise functionality in the participants section of the webinar. I will try to recognize you. If you don't have that functionality for any reason, try to physically raise your hand and I will try to recognize you. We try to recognize people as, you know, they sort of raise their hand so that we don't go out of order, and we try to recognize everybody and give them time to speak if they should so choose. Today we've got a pretty busy agenda. We've got Laura Ruglis to talk about interim policy 6.4. We've got Chief Honan here with some guests. We've got a discussion on the staff health forum that we just had, a wellness panel that we're going to have coming up in 2 weeks, and then a vote on David Heiner to the University Assembly. So I'm going to begin with the first business of the day, which is Laura. I'm going to allow Joe Canella right now to introduce her. So the floor is yours, Joe.
Thank you kindly. It's my pleasure to be working with Laura on the interim revisions to policy 6.4. Many of you know Laura, I'm sure, having worked with her in the past. She is Associate Vice President for Institutional Equity and the Title IX Coordinator for the university. And that office is responsible for administrating policy 6.4, the anti-bias policy. The federal government recently made changes to Title IX, which require institutions downstream to make corresponding changes to their own Title IX policy and procedures. So Laura has a short slide deck. Our ask of you is to listen with a critical ear. We are actively seeking input for things that we can take to the policy executives, and Laura will call those out as she's going through the meeting. So like I said, it's my pleasure to work with her and it's my pleasure to introduce her. So Laura, take it away. Would you like me to run the slide deck, or do you have it?
I have it, but if you will do it, that would be terrific. Thank you so much. And thanks for the introduction.
My pleasure. Hey, can you kindly enable me to share my screen?
And thank you all for this time with you today. I'll be very respectful of the agenda scheduling here, and a special hello to Nasser, who's with the Office of Institutional Equity and Title IX, as you probably know. He's an excellent colleague. I've been here at Cornell since January, and so this is really my first opportunity to connect with the employee assembly. And so, Joe, if you do want to throw the slides up, we can jump right in and get to the heart of the conversation today.
We're working through the sharing of the screen.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Bingo.
So policy 6.4 is really what I would call kind of the civil rights policy for Cornell University. It serves as our Title IX policy, but also addresses other types of civil rights issues across the spectrum of protected statuses. So not only gender-based harassment, sexual misconduct, but also race, disability, the full range of statuses that are protected by law. Okay, we can go ahead and jump into the next slide. And so as Joe touched upon, there were some changes made at the federal level. They're legal changes to the Title IX regulations. And we had a very short period of time to react to those changes, really about 3 months this summer, during a time when, as you all know all too well, people were very busy with other things. So we really did not have an opportunity to engage with the university community about these changes. And as I touched upon, some of them are just legally required. Some, not all of the changes that were made to policy 6.4 are legally required as a result of these regulations. And the regulations apply specifically to sexual harassment as the regulations define sexual harassment. So hopefully everyone's taken HR 300, which is the university's Title IX training. And this is not completely unfamiliar, but we thought it would make sense just to give a little more grounding in how the regulations define sexual harassment. So I think we can jump to the next slide. So again, this is what these new regulations strictly apply to. A university can choose to apply the new requirements beyond what is here on your screen, but these new requirements have to be applied minimally to this type of behavior and when these jurisdictional conditions are met. We won't walk through all of the definitions. Again, hopefully it's looking familiar from HR 300, but just wanted to flash this up there so you would have a framework for these new legal requirements. Okay, so let me break it down a little bit more in terms of the procedures. So we have policy 6.4, and we now have three sets of procedures, two employee sets and one student set. It used to be that we had more procedures, and so we tried to streamline it a little bit. So let's focus on the employee procedures. We have Title IX procedures now and non-Title IX procedures. And that slide that showed you the behaviors, how sexual harassment is defined in those jurisdictional conditions, when those are met, the Title IX procedures for employees apply. So in the employee context, we're applying these new procedures very narrowly and strictly to only that which is required by the law. And then we have for everything else that falls outside that regulatory framework, non-Title IX procedures for employees. So this is a big change here because you'll see that some sexual behavior which falls outside of that regulatory framework is now in the non-Title IX procedures. And the difference between these two procedures for employees really comes at the adjudication stage. So you can see there's an investigation, it's very thorough. And then there is an adjudication stage. When we're talking about the Title IX procedures, it's a hearing panel process. And now, as a result of these new regulatory requirements, that hearing panel process includes cross-examination that's conducted by parties' advisors. In the non-Title IX procedures, the adjudication process is through the investigation and the unit head, that reviewer. So that reviewer process is in lieu of a hearing panel process. And then under both sets of procedures, you have an appeal. I don't think we have enough time to really walk through the student procedures, but if anybody has questions about those, we can talk about them. Next slide. So what is the stakeholder review all about? Well, because we did not have an opportunity this summer to really engage around the changes that needed to be made to policy 6.4, the decision was made to put policy 6.4 in an interim status. So these changes were adopted on sort of an interim basis, knowing that we wanted to hear more from the community about them. And so that's what's happening now with this stakeholder review group. So every assembly is represented as part of this group. We also have the Tech campus and the WOW campus represented as well. And we've been meeting every couple weeks, and Joe has served the employee assembly well as a representative to the stakeholder review group, and really identifying what some of the key issues may be and going to the different groups, the assemblies, and hearing from them. So we really want to have some opportunity today to hear from you. But if you're not prepared to comment, we still have about another week where comments can be submitted. Okay, next slide.
Laura, are there representatives from the Geneva Agritech campus as well?
We do not have a specific representative from the Geneva Agritech campus. Is there someone here today who's from that campus? And we can also ensure that there is involvement through some other communications. So Joe, if you want, we can talk offline further about that. Okay, next slide, yeah. So these are the main discussion items that the stakeholder review group has identified through its own internal discussions and through conversations that the representatives have had with their constituents. And I think some of these are fairly logical. So for example, in the regulations, one of the things that was that institutions are allowed to do is choose between evidentiary standards. This gets a little bit technical, so please bear with me. Cornell has had the preponderance of the evidence standard, and of the two standards that are allowed, this is the lower one. So we have preponderance, which is more likely than not, anything more than 50%. And the other standard that's allowed under the regulations is clear and convincing. And we can choose between those, and we just have to ensure that that same standard is applied across faculty, staff, and student sexual harassment cases. So this was not changed as a result of the regulations. It does not need to be changed. It can be changed, however. This conversation came up under the code of conduct discussions. Can we have a different standard of evidence in the code of conduct than we do under policy 6.4? And we can. So it could be clear and convincing there and preponderance of the evidence under policy 6.4 under the law. Designated reporters, and again, this was outlined in HR 300, but we've moved away from all non-confidential employees being required to report or consult with the Title IX office around issues of student sexual assault, dating and domestic violence, and stalking. And we now have identified specific designated reporters based really on their roles. And there are some offices that across the board are designated reporter offices. I see colleagues from CUPD, and they are all designated reporters, for example. One of the reasons for this change is that the research indicates that when you have systems where all employees are mandatory reporters, it actually creates institutional distrust and deprives the person who has experienced the conduct of their agency to bring information forward. And particularly with these new requirements that we're under as a result of the regulations, if someone is not willing to participate in a process, more often than not, there is very little that the institution will be able to do in terms of addressing that situation. There are, of course, exceptions to that, but we will need the people who have experienced the behavior of the complainants in most cases to be deeply involved and committed to participating in the process. I have separated this out. So that's the policy, the four corners of the policy, and then attached to the policy are the procedures. So you recall our chart from just a few minutes ago. And there have been some changes made there, which the hearing panel process is the big one with the addition of this new type of cross-examination that will be included in our process. And then alternate resolution, we've taken this opportunity to really expand on the different means that we can use to resolve a report or a complaint apart from the formal resolution, which involves the investigation and adjudication. And then additionally, and Joe, I don't know if you want to speak further to this, but some members of the review group have interest in looking at how we can outline further how the university responds to bias, which doesn't constitute a policy 6.4 violation, and define the protected statuses that are covered by policy 6.4. Joe, is there anything you'd like to elaborate upon on this slide?
I can just point to this and ask my fellow committee mates to remember me speaking of the overlaps between the work that the group that's looking at policy 6.4 is looking at, as well as the biases toward LGBT plus members of our faculty and staff. This would be the intersection of those two. So it kind of all is of a piece. So that's what I was referring to specifically the last time we were together. Thanks, Laura.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. Okay. I think we are at the end of the presentation, and hopefully we have some time remaining if anyone would like to offer any feedback, comments, or has any questions.
If there are any questions, please use the hand raise functionality or actually physically raise your hand. I right now do not see any. Oh, here we go. Brandon Fortenberry.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for that great presentation. So I recently took on the chair of the Codes and Judicial Committee, so have learned a little bit about evidentiary standards that I didn't think I would ever learn in my job as a catering director. And I wondered what the thought process is behind the decision-making process for this evidentiary standard. It's been a pretty hot topic for the student code side of things. So I wondered if you could speak to a little bit about how that ultimate decision will be made.
And preponderance, thank you, Brandon. Good question. Preponderance is a standard that's used in all equity cases, and it's also the standard that's used in civil litigation. So when you have discrimination cases that are litigated in court, those are civil matters. And the standard that the courts apply is preponderance of the evidence. So that has been, I would say, the sort of time-honored established standard, whether you're talking about administrative policies, like at universities, or you're talking about the judicial process. So I think that's a big, big factor weighing in favor of preponderance of the evidence standard. When clear and convincing is considered, which is the higher, more probable standard, when you look at it in the judicial context, it's applied when the harm to the person who might be found responsible or guilty is far greater than the harm to the other party. So if you look at it through, I'm not articulating this as well as I'd like, but for example, it's used in parental termination cases. It's not used very often actually in the court system. And so the idea is if you get it wrong in a parental termination case, depriving that parent of the rights to their child is really a significant penalty. So when you're looking at it in the lens of, let's say, sexual harassment or a type of sexual misconduct, you have two parties who would suffer equal harm by the wrong result, if that makes sense. You'd have a complainant who is presenting as the victim of some very serious misconduct, and then you have the person who will, of course, face some consequences if found responsible for that conduct. So in that particular context, preponderance of the evidence may make a whole lot more sense than in your code of conduct context. And if that raised more questions than it answered, I'd be glad to circle back around with you, Brandon, outside of the time that we have today.
Absolutely. I think that might be a good follow-up. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, Laura. Are there any other questions? I'm looking around. I feel like this was a very helpful presentation. And also, if there are any questions or comments after this presentation, would it be all right if we sent those questions to you? And when? What would be the time frame for this?
So those questions, and Joe, I'm not going to volunteer you, but if you want to volunteer yourself, they can...
I will take this bullet for you. Yeah, it is a really short turnaround time because of other work that is happening at the same time that this has to interface with. So it's questions that you have about anything that we spoke about need to be submitted to that email address that you saw. Help me, Laura, title9@cornell.edu, title IX@cornell.edu. They need to be submitted by December 8th. That is fast, I know, and courses and finals and other craziness is going on everywhere. So I'm grateful for that. One of the things that should help guide your thinking and what questions you may have is the redlined comparison document that has been loaded into the box folder, which compares old policy 6.4 to new policy 6.4 and how it has changed. If you'd like me to dig up the 900 some odd page Title IX regulation for you, I would be more than happy to do that as well.
I think we're all right. Thank you for volunteering. Well, thank you so much, Laura. I'll ask all employee assembly members to, you know, take a look at the documentation available in the box and then send over the commentary to the title9@cornell.edu email address should they have any. So again, thank you, Laura. We will now move on to our second guest of this meeting. This will be Chief Honan. I'm going to pin him on the screen. Hello, Chief Honan, how are you?
Good, thank you. And thank you very much for having us in to speak to the Employee Assembly. We sincerely appreciate the invite. And I also want to introduce with me is Deputy Chief Jeff Montesano, who's my Deputy Chief of my Deputy Chief of Professional Standards. He handles all my training and accreditation, make sure we're following the law and we're following all the training standards that police need to have. And Deputy Chief Anthony Bellamy, who is in charge of all of our police operations and community engagement. And why I wanted to bring them here is just so that you see who they are. If you ever need something, you can't get a hold of me. It's Deputy Chief Bellamy or Deputy Chief Montesano or who you want to reach out to. There's always going to be at least one of us on duty 24/7 to answer questions. So thank you for having all of us. Can I share my screen and go ahead and start a presentation?
You should be able to. Okay.
Okay, I hope everybody's seeing the picture that's way nicer than any picture I could take of Cornell. And so talking about Cornell Police, again, thank you for having me. I haven't had a chance since I became chief to speak with the employee assembly, so I thought it'd be a great opportunity just to do a quick review and of who we are and how we deliver our services to the Cornell community. One thing that I really want to get out there is what is our mission? What do we do here? Our mission is service. It has been since 2005. One piece of our mission that I really want to highlight for everybody is that, you know, we perform all the same functions as any municipal police department, but then everything that's unique to Cornell and delivering the service that we need to for our unique community on how important it is for us to deliver a safe and secure environment for the academic freedom that's just needed in an institution such as this. And we strive to make sure that we have a foundation of community service, crime prevention, and most importantly, respect and preserve human dignity of all individuals served. There's been a lot of talk recently about reimagining public safety. Our mission, that was our mission since 2005. And I think a lot of police agencies are striving to find a mission similar as they're reimagining public safety. And I'm sure you've seen community forums. There's an executive order from municipal police departments to have forums and get input from the community to reimagine public safety. On campus for many years now, as mandated by New York State education law, we have the Public Safety Advisory Committee. It's composed of students, staff, and faculty appointed through shared governance bodies to advise the Cornell Police on issues of public safety, victims advocacy, and accordance with New York State education law. In July of this year, President Pollack charged the PSAC with reimagining public safety at Cornell and submit its report and recommendations to EVP DeStefano by the end of the academic term. The committee traditionally is met once a month, sometimes just once a semester. But with this change, we're re-energized and we want to do a lot of work. So the group's decided to meet twice a month and we're continuing to make some good progress. Again, appointments to the committee are made annually and they come through the assemblies. Agendas and minutes are publicly available on our website. So if you go to cupolice.cornell.edu, you can find the link to the Public Safety Advisory Committee and all of our minutes are available there. Coming soon, some of the work that we're doing, right now I'm still presenting a lot of data to the group, but the group would like to develop some focus groups to speak to members of the community and a community survey. So we're really hoping that the Employee Assembly can help us get word out to our employees who are a good portion of our community to comment on the survey when it comes out. Tell us how you think we're doing. We don't know if we're doing good or bad if we don't have feedback from our community. And that's really important to us to know that we're delivering the services that the Cornell community wants. So Cornell University Police are committed to diversity, fair and impartial, and anti-racist policing. And we pledge to be partners to ensure that all are treated with dignity and respect and to be here when you need us. And you know, regardless of your position on campus for or against police, we're here to make sure everybody is safe. We're here to deliver professional police service to anybody. So we're committed to that, and we're committed to that through our training and on our delivery of our services. And people have asked me, like, how do you ensure you're meeting these community expectations? We make sure we're doing it through people, policy, and professionalism. We are people ourselves in the Cornell community, and you see patrol officers out there each day on campus. Each week I present the blue light message, which I try to tailor to not only students, but staff and faculty as well. If you haven't caught a Donuts with Dave thing, it's not good for my diet, so we may have to change the name of that, but we're looking for any opportunity to get out there and engage with our community. Certainly the pandemic has made it difficult. Once pandemic's over, we'll be back in Willard Street Hall doing popcorn with the police as well, and many other community events. Events and training geared towards employees specifically, we do security surveys, workplace violence prevention training, active killer response, and active killer training as to what you should do in your workplace, and any other specific crime prevention program you could want through our crime prevention program. They're always available, and We deliver as many presentations to employees as we do students. We've also developed the Rave Guardian app, which you can download on your phone. It's like a personal blue light or a panic alarm right in your pocket. You can use that to text, message us here at the Cornell Police, send us pictures if you want, and walking escorts day and night. There's also links to important safety information here at Cornell. As part of our people pledge, we make sure we hire and retain people that not only have the technical skills needed to be police officers here at Cornell, but the cultural skills to take care of our community. We take care of people and we treat people right. Policy, our policies, which are mandated by state law, federal law, university policy, are informed by best practice and our mission to protect our community. And it provides a very clear framework and expectations to our officers of how we'd like them to do their job. Professionalism, as an accredited agency, all of my officers are trained in de-escalation, implicit bias, recognition, procedural justice, mental health crisis response, critical incident management, victims advocacy. We do trauma-informed response, interviewing skills. Most importantly, we have a guardian mentality. That is that we are here to guard, to be not be the warriors or mean police officers, but to help protect our community. Our trainings usually exceed most state standards. And most importantly, we hold people accountable. If they don't deliver the service that we want delivered to our community or treat people right, we're gonna hold our staff accountable. Professionalism, we have transparency is so important to be a professional department with your community. Our internal affairs summary is a public document. You can access the right on our website. You can also access our daily crime log. Annual security report, the new one is gonna be due out any day now over the next, I think 2 weeks we'll have that published to our website, but you can see last year's is available there right now. Certainly once the pandemic is over, we offer ride-alongs and department tours. So if you're ever curious about how we do what we do, come with us and you can actually do a ride-along and see how we deliver our services. Accountability, as I said, we have a high degree of internal and external accountability for our staff. There's always a supervisor on duty. That supervisor performs regular field visits, work review, and they're always here to take a complaint. So if you're ever concerned that we didn't deliver the service we need to, or you weren't happy with the service delivered, you can always call the 255-1111 number, ask to speak to a supervisor, and somebody will call you back. We also have implemented body cameras a couple years ago. So if there's ever a concern about what the interaction was or how the officer performed, we can go back and we can look on the body camera and see exactly how that interaction unfolded. We've also added non-lethal use of force options so that officers have more tools. So if they're in a situation, they have, as I said, more tools available to them so they don't have to go to lethal force. We have a broad and diverse engagement on campus. There are many committees and many teams that we are part of from the Transportation Safety Council, the ALERT team, the University Threat Assessment team, crime prevention, safety and planning, cops, kids and toys, event planning, dignitary protection, undocumented and DACA support group support, child safety seat inspections, which is mainly focused towards our staff on campus, making sure you have a safe seat to put your child in, bring a child to work day, lost and found, many mentoring programs, Gorge Safety Committee, and many other programs. We also make sure that we are audited. We have an outside audit and a partnership with University Audit. We're an accredited agency, accredited by IACLEA. And University Audit actually participates in auditing some of our files and our property in support of that accreditation. The accreditation also requires annual reviews of our use of force, biased policing, and our internal affairs. The racial profiling review for accreditation, in that we look at, you know, what is the people that we refer or arrest or ticket, you know, what is the racial composition of that? Is there any concerns of bias in our policing? We look at our complaints and we look at community feedback and see if there's any concerns there that would indicate racial profiling on part of an officer. We also make sure that we have appropriate training that occurs annually to support unbiased and anti-racist policing. Annual investigation analysis. It's continuing downward. Each year, our internal investigations go down. Certainly with the implementation of body cameras, a lot of issues are resolved before a complaint is even filed. And as you can see, our trend is just going down year over year. Our use of force policy. We have a pretty thorough use of force policy and have had it in place for years. We have extensive training in use of force. As you can see, the benchmarks that are outlined in the Campaign Zero's A Can't Wait project, we had in practice and in our training and is all things we expected of our officer. But in January of 2020, we did our annual review and realized that we wanted to make the two items that were missing in the middle column explicit in our policy. We did them in practice, we did them in training, but they weren't explicit. So when we updated our policy, we made sure that they were in place. How do we move forward from here? We're gonna have practical and classroom training for Cornell Police. We believe in training is the best way to cure any issues and to properly have people understanding how we want them delivering our services to the community. Posting information and data to the CUPD website. There's been a lot of requests for additional data to be made public. So I'm working on an improvement to our website where we're gonna post some additional information there. As I said earlier, the Public Safety Advisory Committee has been moved to the Executive Vice President. And the President has also directed the development of a community response team, which is gonna be housed in SCL. But you know, as many of you experienced throughout this pandemic, there is just a lot of heavy lifting going around across this university. And it is just not in place yet. So that is something that is still on the agenda and still being planned and worked on. And with that, I'd be happy to, I'm sorry, I just threw a lot of information out there, but I'd be happy to take any questions from here.
Thank you, Chief David Honan. I think that was a really informative presentation. I believe that Joe Canella had his hand up, then Jamie, then Ellen. So Joe?
David, thank you for that. That was really thorough. You have to work on your memes. Kathy, we missed a little bit of Kathy Zoner's sense of humor there, but I was curious about how you disaggregate the information and analyze the data about incidents and who's involved and, you know, being conscious of checking yourself for those, you know, perhaps hidden biases. So what kinds of information are you collecting in order to determine whether there are biases or not?
Yeah, so so I'm sorry about the memes. Just with the pandemic, it has been such a such a heavy topic that I want to be very careful that people don't think I'm making light of that issue. So Kathy was the pro at the memes. I'm going to try to get my game here as we move out of the pandemic. I'd be happy to take any advice from anybody on that. Mm-hmm. How do we do the racial profile? So what we do is we look at what's the thing that has the most adverse impact to our community. That's traffic tickets, criminal arrests, referral to JA. And in each of those cases, we mandate that our officers indicate the race of the person that they have had to have that adverse action against. We then take those totals and we compare them against the demographics of our university and see if there's any outliers or any trends. The one trend that we noticed this year was our officers actually weren't completing that field as much as they should have. So there's a couple more unknowns, but when I compare it to previous years, the unknowns, our interactions with white community members went down as the unknowns went up. The interactions with other races stayed the same. So we've had to go back and we've had to reinforce with our staff the importance of indicating that. And then moving forward, we would love to try to capture more information of everybody that we come in contact with, but we have thousands and thousands of contacts and most of them positive. So a key request, an escort, helping somebody with a broken down car, you know, that's a much different interaction than something that has an adverse effect. So we're trying to figure out what's the best way to try to capture that information. But then we combine the aggregate data that we have with, okay, what are our complaints coming in? What are the community concerns that we're hearing? what are things that we've observed ourselves as supervisors in interactions with our officers? So if we have witnessed something ourselves, that's a red flag for us to say, whoa, we need to correct an issue with that officer, or we need better training for the whole department.
Okay, great. As the LGBTQ plus rep, I'll get on my soapbox and say, having information about LGBTQ plus folks being involved in incidents, either as perpetrators or victims, that kind of data would be really helpful. So I'd encourage you to look into that if possible.
Okay, I'd love to talk offline because I want to be really sensitive and we're collecting data that I don't want to put somebody in a position where they're self-disclosing something they may not be comfortable disclosing.
And prefer not to say is always a good answer. So, I'd be happy to talk offline. I work in Day Hall, so it's just the hop, skip, and a jump to you.
We're neighbors, practically. Yeah. So yeah, feel free to reach out and I'd be happy to figure out if there's a way we could share data back and forth to make sure that the community you represent, that we're delivering the proper service there.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you both. Moving on to Jamie.
Hey, David, thank you for being here with us. I have three questions. The first was, I think you might have just answered it, but it's about how do you determine what someone's race or ethnicity is? Is that a determination by the officer on the scene, or is that something they ask? The second question is, with your internal affairs reports, there's previous year data that shows things like investigations that had sustained investigations, but then no corrective actions listed or mentioned on you know, what took place after that. So I don't know if that's just a reporting issue or if nothing actually does happen even from a sustained investigation. And then finally, when it comes to all the types of calls that CUPD goes out on, is there any, you know, investigation of that data to say, you know, what percentage of these calls really require an armed officer on the scene, and which of these could be handled by some other type of, you know, less highly skilled, highly trained person that doesn't need to have a license to carry a lethal weapon on campus?
Okay, I'll try to unpack all that. I think the first one was, how do we identify? And that is by officer's observation. So the accusations are usually that the officer did so because they believe somebody was blank. It is the officer's observation and observation only. The second part was, did you say that we had a sustained, but it didn't show a corrective action on our report? Am I understanding that?
The 2017 had three sustained investigations, but there was nothing listed for any corrective actions taken. And I was just curious about that.
Yeah, so if we sustain a complaint, there is at least a counseling, sometimes a discipline that occurs as a result of that. So I'll have to go back and take a look at that report and see why that's not accurately reflected, if that's part of that report.
And then the third thing about the types of cases that require or don't require lethal weapons to be included in that.
Sure, that's a challenging thing. So I'm gonna preface this with, yes, there are a lot of things that we do at the Cornell Police that have been passed along to us here at the Cornell Police because we are the people that are here 24/7, 365 days a year. I would love to have some of that stuff handed off to other staff if they wanted to handle that. The other part is you can't always predict what the call is. So just, I think it was just yesterday, there was an officer that responded to a parking complaint and then was engaged with a handgun and ended up getting in a gun battle. And that officer's fighting for her life today. So you don't always know. So the weapons that we have are defensive weapons. They're put in place to protect ourselves and third parties. That's why they're also located in secure carriers on our belts or in the vehicles, that the officers don't just pull them out. So I'm hoping I'm answering your question, but the challenge is every call is just so unique, and each, especially when there's a serious call, seconds count. So if there were an active killer or a very serious incident involving a weapon, every second matters to the officer to engage with the subject and stop the loss of life.
Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to Ellen, then Andrea. Ellen?
Hi, thanks for coming here today and explaining to us about what you do and all the services that you provide. I really appreciate it. I wanted to know, I have a few questions as well. I wanted to know how many officers are usually on duty at any given time, and what is your radius that you cover? Because I know you do cover parts of Ithaca outside of the direct Cornell campus. So I wanted to know exactly what that encompasses.
So, you know, every shift can vary depending on our staffing, you know, as we employees that get hurt, out sick, out for various life issues, or quarantined recently. Our staffing can fluctuate a little bit. So we have actually four different beats that we've divided the campus up to based upon analysis of call volume and density. And we minimally staff at least three officers and a sergeant each shift. So we have enough staff that we can take any of our criminal arms require two officer minimum. So that still leaves us an officer to handle other calls when we have a criminal, a burglar alarm, or a holdup alarm, or anything like that. And it, we can have on Wednesdays are our training days. So nobody gets Wednesday off at the Cornell Police. Everybody works. So if we don't have training on those days where we send some people off to a classroom or to a Zoom meeting to have their training, everyone's working. So that's the day you're most likely to see officers out on foot, out on bikes. That can be eight or nine officers and two sergeants. Every other day can be somewhere in the middle, depending on what else we have going. We will supplement officers if it's going to be a busy day with special details. We'll move officers from one shift to another. We'll force them to work extra duty at times. So I'm hoping I answered the staffing question. And then if our jurisdiction is unique. When you get to a municipal police department, you actually have a nice neat boundary. Usually it's okay, you're the City of Ithaca Police, you patrol within that boundary. We're a property specific police. We patrol Cornell owned or controlled property. And then we also have jurisdiction on any public highway adjacent or adjoining. So that when you look at the total volume of property that Cornell handles, it's a good chunk of property. It's bigger than the City of Ithaca. So we regularly patrol West Campus, so the University Avenue, Stewart Avenue area, over to College Town in the south, and then all the way out east to past where the old State Fleet Garage is. It's about our limit there. And then to the south, we'll go just south of East Hill Plaza, the Polo Barns, Hungerford Hill, and then up to the north, up into the Village Cuga Heights. That's what we consider our primary response area. Any other property that Cornell owns within Tompkins County is considered our secondary response area. We only respond there if requested or at the direction of a supervisor, or there's a request from one of the other police agencies that would may normally handle a call there that wants us to handle a call on our property outside of our primary response area. And then response outside of Tompkins County is only with my permission, and it's extremely rare.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Andrea?
I just wanted to say I'm a new member of the Public Safety Advisory Committee. And so just the breadth and the depth of the knowledge that I'm gaining of all of the work that you're doing, as well as the responsiveness that you've done for the Public Safety Advisory Committee and sort of going into our focus groups and other activities is acknowledged and appreciated, Dave. I just wanted to let you know that, it's a lot. And it's got a really aggressive agenda. I welcome folks to look at the link that has been put up. I think Gina had put up a link to that in the work that you're doing. So if anyone else is interested in any of that from the I encourage them to reach out to Dave. It's not like you've got a lot of extra time with all of the stuff that you're gathering for us. And so it's just acknowledged and appreciated.
Great, thank you. Thank you for participating, because it is going to be a lot of work, but I think we're going to be much better off in the end with the input of all members of our community advising the university what they want to see in their police department.
Thank you. And Ellen, you have your hand raised again.
Yeah, I just also wanted to mention, I just saw Michelle has her physical hand raised. I forgot she doesn't have the function, so I'm sorry if I skipped you, Michelle. I just wanted to say also, as the vice chair for communications for the employee assembly, if there's any way that we can help CUPD engage with staff or employees on campus, please let us know. Like, we're happy to help in any way and partner with you on anything that we can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and Michelle?
Well, that was gonna be my statement question, ways in which the EA can work with CUPD would be most appreciated. I think that we would like to work together on any issues that you see overlap with what our mission is in shared governance for the university. So thank you.
Thank you, and we'll be available to meet with anybody from the employee assembly, and Anthony and Jeff, between the three of us, please give us a call anytime. You know, if you hear we're not doing something right, or we could do something better, but also if we can be of assistance, and we'll do the same. Really appreciate having an opportunity to speak with everybody and the offer of assistance. So we'll be sure to send anything along if we have it.
Thank you very much. So with that said, there are no more questions. We will move on to our next agenda item, but thank you all for joining us. I think it's really helpful to learn about, all of these, tasks that you're working on, and learning about de-escalation, mental health response, trauma-informed response, holding people accountable. I think it's really important to hear that this work is happening. And I'm looking forward to, working together if there's anything you need from the employee assembly. So thank you again. Okay, so now I'm going to unpin you, and we are going to move on to our next item of the day, which is a postmortem discussion of yesterday's staff health forum. So we had about, judging from the data, about 662 unique views. We answered six pre-submitted questions and 19 Q&A from the webinar yesterday. So I think we got through a lot of content in yesterday's staff health forum. I wanted to open the floor for employee assembly members to talk about, what you thought was helpful, if, you have any suggestions for improvement for other upcoming forums, or if you just want to talk about the forum. So I'm going to open this up for any open discussion. Please raise your hand physically or using the functionality. Michelle?
Sure. I would like to just share the feedback that I've been hearing so far from colleagues is it was very well received, appreciated, and they felt that it was very professionally run. So appreciated the time from Dr. Jones and Clark to be there to answer the questions. So that's what I'm hearing so far.
Thank you, Michelle. Brian?
Hi. Hey, I thought it was excellent. I got a lot of information. I thought it was well done. I thank everybody that contributed. The only question I got after the event, I got an email from Peter asking me if does one need to be an EA member to get their question answered. Apparently his question wasn't answered. Do we store or save the questions that aren't answered and send them a response, or do we answer them? I'm not sure.
So good question. What we usually do, and I believe Ellen provided a link in the chat, is the recording and the transcript are available for everything, you know, that was gone over during the staff forum. I know there was a question previously that somebody had asked in regards to any unanswered questions, if we can then have, you know, somebody answer it. And I believe I owe you all a response on that. So I've spoken to Mary Opperman about it. And this is something we've discussed not only this year, but in prior years in regards to these forums. And it sounds like there is sort of, there's a lack of time, you know, to be able to answer all of the questions that were not answered, to be able to sift through every questions and say these were unanswered, and then go to all the sources and then get all that feedback, compile it, and then post it. It is a lot to ask of, you know, the Office of the Assembly, is to ask of administration. So we try, and with all these forums that we have, to address, you know, some key concerns, and then you know, if we have other forums, try to, you know, pull anything that wasn't addressed in the past to bring that to the forefront. But that's sort of the perspective that we have, that it is a lot of work to be able to, you know, sift through any unanswered questions and then bring it back. Michelle, you have your hand raised. And then I think Brandon, I see your hand is raised. So Michelle?
I just want to follow up and say that a lot of, so in reviewing the questions that come in live, I filter some of them and try to roll them into, especially if they're in the same sort of ballpark as you know, a lot of the questions coming in. And I believe that the questions this time did come through just to the panelists and not to the entire webinar audience. So, and I also looked at the questions and felt that those ones that weren't really being answered on the CU Health website. So if there was information available on the CU Health website for a lot of the questions, then I really wanted to focus on questions that I didn't see could be readily answered on that sort of platform. So if you think that that's not the best way to get, you know, to do the forums, I'm happy to, you know, for your feedback on that. But I think that some of the questions that were coming through were just not, you know, they weren't going to either be answered by them because of the nature of the question and making, you know, I remember his question though, Brian. I thought, you know, a lot of it is going to be using the information that was already given by Drs. Jones and Clark, and then you need to take your own personal accountability on whether or not you're going to, you know, wear a mask or maintain 6 feet, or, you know, a lot of those questions were, you know, in the realm of personal responsibility and health and safety. So I did choose questions that I knew the experts can give an answer to, that provided, you know, with their expertise and the research available. And some of the other questions I think would have been a little bit tougher to answer, to be quite honest. So
thanks, Michelle. So I want to get to Brandon, Ellen, then Brian. This is the order I'm seeing in the participants. So Brandon.
Yeah, I think I definitely hear you, Michelle. There's some things that come through on those chats that are challenging to manage and understand. Some of them aren't even questions. They may be statements or things that don't actually have an answer to them. I do think there is some value in trying to look at a way in which to get more questions answered through those things. It's very short. It's a very short window. You can look at it. You may get, you know, 100 questions, and you're really only able to answer, you know, 10 if you're lucky, you know, considering how long it may take 3 people to answer one question. So I think I really greatly appreciate the staff forums and think they've been tremendously effective in providing clarity and understanding for the campus. And I think there's an opportunity to take some of the questions that come from those and allow for folks to be able to respond, to expand on that transparency and that that openness that we are hoping to have here on campus.
Thank you, Brendan. Moving on to Ellen.
Yeah, I would just agree with Michelle and Brandon that unfortunately we can't ask and answer every single question because there's just not enough time. And I think there has to be some filtering that happens behind the scenes. So that's what's going on. But as Hey mentioned, we will list all of the questions on the website, and we can have the, we can have the committee chairs take a look at them if it's something that maybe your committee can tackle on a local basis to get answers in general to the population. That would be helpful, I think. And unfortunately, I don't think we received very many responses to the Qualtrics that was sent out in advance of the forum. So I would just encourage the EA body to, when we do have these forums, share that out as much as you can with your constituents and your contacts so that we can get those questions in advance, because it does help guide the discussion for the panelists so that there's a little more focus on what people are interested in knowing about.
Thank you, Ellen. And you're correct. Every question that was pre-submitted was asked on the webinar. And Brian?
So, and I understand. I totally get it. I was wondering if during the forums, there was a way that we could let the viewers know that, first of all the questions can't be answered. It's not possible. The second thing would maybe attach a link where they can get their answers if they via email. So they can post their questions after the event to get them answered. I don't know if that's possible or not with different individuals or different groups or whatever, but maybe that we can do something like that. Maybe that'll help. I don't know. This is the second time this guy's reached out to me complaining, and he, I don't know. I don't know what his questions are. I just know that he says that they're not getting answered. I don't know.
All right. So Michelle, you'll be the final one, and then we'll move on to the next order of business. Michelle?
I didn't lose my train of thought there. all right. Let me see. So let's see. How many questions? I want to say that I did have people ask questions, and I responded directly to them during the Q&A when I could, especially if they were asking questions like, can you share the website site for CHS? So I did that. The other thing is, Gina might be able to answer this, or Wendy. I think we can get a record or a transcript of the questions from the webinar. I think it's all somehow in there if you save it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't want Peter to feel that he's being ignored or unheard. So I think that Ellen's suggestion of, going back through the questions and maybe having the committees or the executive committee, we can just go through them and figure out ways to reach out and answer them. I think I think that's reasonable, and I'm more than happy to help, do something like that. So.
Thank you. So I think that's a good idea, trying to answer some of these questions that were unanswered if we move them to the EA chairs for answering. I think that is a possible venue. Let us move on with 12 minutes left to the other business of the day. We'll put a hold on that. So we have a wellness forum coming up in less than 2 weeks. So this is not going to be like a traditional staff forum. This winter wind down is in partnership with HR well-being and other individuals like Michelle Arderby, Ruth Doyle, Merle Doyle. This has been an effort led by Christy Mahoney. And really it will be more like a panel. It'll be a discussion with wellness professionals on campus, talking to people from FSAP, with people who work in nutrition, to talk about, you know, thoughts and suggestions for wellness, you know, as we think about, you know, what are some key issues that we would like to tackle, looking at some early priorities poll data. You know, health and wellness is standing out as a leading issue for staff members right now. So I think it is also a really timely opportunity to kind of address some of these issues that we're seeing with staff members. So that is going to be December 14th. I hope if you could publicize this opportunity, that would be great. I think it's helpful for people to kind of feel that we are, as you know, the employee assembly, working on issues that really directly impact the staff. So I want to open this up for questions, comments. Ellen, I see your hand is raised.
Yeah, I just wanted to let everyone know that I will be sending out resources to publicize the event. I am working on those materials now, posters, flyers, link, website links, event pages, all that stuff. So I'll be sending that out to the EA body later this week, so you have those. We do have a website set up already on the assemblies page. Thank you to Wendy. So I'll put that in the chat now, but the other information will be forthcoming.
Thank you, Ellen. Anyone else, as these
come up, is there a way that we could add them to our signature, or should we keep EA business away from our day-to-day business? What's best practice?
Christy, I see you've got some head motion, so I'm going to allow you to have the floor.
In my opinion, this business is our business. So I have EA links at the bottom of my signature and email. I send notices from the EA out widely. I don't separate, but that's my opinion.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other comments on this winter wind down? I don't see any hands raised. Let's move on to the UA rep. So the University Assembly has, you know, employee reps. So we recently had somebody step down. So I would like to sort of read to you a brief description from David Heiner, who would like to join the University Assembly. He has been on the University Assembly before, and then we will vote to see if we agree to let him on to the University Assembly. So here is his message that he sent to me that I'm going to read to you all. Dear members of the Employee Assembly, thank you for taking the time to consider my appointment to the University Assembly today. Over the past 2.5 years, I previously held the LGBTQ representative at large seat on the EA and concurrently a seat on the UA as an employee representative. While on the UA, I was a member of the Campus Welfare Committee and later chaired that committee. I'm seeking your approval today to be appointed to the UA, to continue to be a voice for the staff and to continue to be a part of shared governance. Currently, I'm an LGBTQ CNG board member where I hear the struggles of staff. It's through the good things I hear that I believe we should be promoting agendas that strengthen staff's well-being through benefits, infrastructure, and just simple things that make an employee's life a little easier. As a voice on the UA, I will also act with staff's interests in mind and will strive to be your voice. I humbly ask that you consider my appointment to the UA. So do I have a motion to vote on David Heiner's appointment to the UA?
So moved.
Okay, do I get a second? Michelle, great. So please use the participants functionality and select yes, the green yes, vote for yes, no, if you do not approve, and then type in abstain in the chat if you abstain from this vote. So I believe we do have quorum. Right now I am seeing 18 votes for yes. Kate, did you have your hand raised?
No, I was just trying to figure out how to say that I was voting yes, but I clicked yes.
Okay, great. So we have 21 yeses, and I believe we have 21 EA members. So unanimously, we have voted him into the UA. I'm going to notify Logan, who is the chair of the University Assembly, and I will notify David that he is now on the UA. Okay. Thank you all for that vote. So now let us move on to the committee reports. So I'm going to start with Michelle for the executive committee.
Be really brief. Our discussion on the 23rd was the end date for the priorities poll, the agenda for this meeting, committee vacancies. I guess I can announce this. Jessica Withers has stepped up to be the new education committee chair. Thank you very much. So very much, Jessica, for your volunteerism. We discussed the student assembly liaison, and I believe Jamie was going to reach out to the operations liaison for the student assembly. So that is all I have. I think we are extending the date of the end date of the priorities poll to this Friday. So if you have an email going out to your constituencies, let them know that it's still up and running. We are only at the 668 submissions out of 7,485 staff. So we're not even at 1%. So let's see if we can't push this priorities poll. And do fill it out if you haven't done so.
is the priorities poll tallied the same way our election poll is tallied?
What do you mean, Joe?
Like, if it's not completely filled out, then it's...
Oh, I think that there's functionality in Qualtrics where we give them a certain period of time. Whatever they've filled out will just automatically get submitted if they abandon it. So whatever feedback they have up to a certain amount of time, it's just going to be captured and counted. There is an update on this, and we have some new submissions. So as of this morning, we have 721 responses. So about an 18% increase from last year, but I would like to see more engagement. So Kit, you have your hand raised.
Yes, I was wondering if an official reminder was also going to be sent out by the EA with the link. You know, if we sent it out to our constituencies, if we sent out a reminder for our constituencies or something's posted on a social media site, for example, by Campus Life, Instagram, can there be an actual, I guess, reminder email sent?
So Ellen, I'm going to let you take this one.
So we don't have the ability to send that by email. We are only allowed to send one email communication per month, which is our EA Voice newsletter, and then one promo email for every event, like specific event that we're having, such as our staff forums. It has been publicized on the Facebook page and the LinkedIn page. I mean, just if you have any other suggestions of where you'd like to see it or where I can post it publicly, please let me know and I will try to get that out. But we don't have too many options.
Thank you, Kate. And then, okay, Kit lowered her hand. So Kate?
Yeah, can you say again what the new deadline is for the priority
poll? It is the end of this week, so this Friday, so December 4th is the deadline. Do you have a link to it? Do you need, I know yesterday during the forum, I provided in the chat the link and I reminded people to take the priorities poll, but I will send you the link.
Thank you.
As soon as I find it.
Division.
Are there any other questions? I don't see any with that. I'm going to move on to communications with Ellen.
I did not prepare an official report, so I'm just kind of looking at my notes from our last meeting. We spent a majority of the meeting talking about the George Peter Award, which we would like to roll out very soon so that we can have hopefully a winner for that award in the coming year. We haven't had one in the last 2 years, so we're really hoping to revamp that. And Kristen Safari from our committee has been working also with Carrie Sanzone on revamping the rubrics for that and all of the communication around it. I need to do some communications with the OA office to see about getting our website revamped and to have their kind of review on the changes that we've made and what we want to do to promote that. So I'll be in touch with them very shortly, but we're excited to get that going and to get that rolling. The George Peter Award should be a very prestigious award. So that's how we want to market it. And we want to make sure that we're really highlighting, you know, the staff on campus in the best way that we can. In addition, we have another EA Voice newsletter coming up on December 14th. And we received some feedback on our last newsletter from Strategic Communications and University Relations. So we are going to be trying to focus the newsletter around specific EA-focused events and news and updates rather than a broader outreach, since there are so many overlapping communications. So we talked about, we'll be promoting the wind down to winter break. That is that day. So we're hoping to get that email out in the morning as just a last minute reminder for the event. And then we'll be entering some information on a recap from the last forum that we did. And we're hoping to also include news from our EA meetings. So today we had two guest speakers. We had, the Title IX presentation as well as the presentation from CUPD. So we're hoping to provide some information on those two presentations in the newsletter. And also hoping to highlight some committee events and member updates. So that's the plan. If you have anything you'd like to include or any suggestions, please reach out to me. And that's pretty much it.
Thank you, Ellen. So it is now 1:30. We're past the time. Do you all want to have a motion to extend this meeting or a motion to end the meeting now? I will leave that up to everyone here. So Michelle, your hand is raised.
A motion to extend.
Okay, do I get a second? Joe has seconded it. So with that, we are going to extend this for 10 more minutes. Are there any questions for Ellen on the communications committee? Seeing none, we're going to move on to the education committee, which now has a new chair. So I will allow either Laura or Jessica provide us with an update on this.
I can give an update. We met on the 20th, I believe, November, and we talked about a number of things. We talked about different ideas for the committee. Lots of great ideas were put out, brainstormed. They're all in the notes. And I just want to thank Jessica for being willing to take this on. So we came up with a lot of ideas, but no strategies for implementing any of them at this point. So thank you, Jessica.
Thank you. Any questions? Comments? Seeing none, we're going to move on to the welfare committee. So I believe Christy had to leave for a meeting. Is there anybody else from the welfare committee that could provide an update? Is there anybody here on the welfare?
I'm on the committee.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to look at my notes quickly. I'm sorry, I should have done that. I think we've been talking about in questions that have come in from constituents. We have discussed things like ageism and the belonging at Cornell survey. We have not been able to see those results yet, but in our discussions about things such as ageism and mentorship and how staff are feeling on campus, we're hopeful to get some answers from that data. We also, Christy's been filling us in about the upcoming wind down to winter that you just mentioned. And also the, I updated them that the UA had approved the resolution last night that you presented, Hey Hey, that was thanking students, that I believe was based on the one that came from the welfare committee here. So that's a very disjointed update for you.
Thank you.
If I can add to that, I would just say that we talked about the Deborah from the Veterans CNG initiatives update. And she did a great job telling everything else.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for the welfare committee?
Well, one more thing. We talked about upcoming things that are happening with the wellness and different things, that events that are happening. Keep your eyes peeled for emails and stuff about a bunch of different things like eCornell and different trainings and different workshops.
Thanks, Brian. Well, while we have you, your the Benefits and Policy Committee report is next. Please use the raise your hand functionality so we'll just so that we can, you know, keep track of everybody. So, Brian?
So we had our meeting on, let me see if I can get the notes up. We had our meeting just recently, and the 24th, I believe it was, of November, and a virtual meeting. And we planned on having Linda Crowell Howell do a presentation for us, but she had to postpone until she can get the approval to do to share the information with us. So we put that off for the next minute meeting. We talked about correspondences setting out and decided that we were talked really extensively about being able to attend and participate in committees and different things and being allowed the time to do that from different areas. And we decided that a letter, a correspondence sent out to Mary O would be the best way to handle that. Hey Hey's taking a lead on that. So we're very appreciative of that and sending that out. We also talked a lot about the priorities poll and ways to get that out to the members and to the community so that we get participation. That we thought that participation was extremely low, and that was kind of saddening. The other thing that we talked about was a resolution thanking the administration for an extra day off, no changes in the health care plan or the contributions for the endowed side. Anyway, we were going to check into the state side, and Cornell resuming full retirement benefits and salaries. So we talked about that and doing a resolution on that, and we're working on that as well. And I think that's it.
You know, any questions? Okay, Michelle, your hand is physically raised.
I just want to say that the draft resolution template is in the committee box folder. So if people want to contribute to that, that would be most appreciated. I'm hoping that we can have something to present to the EA at our meeting on the 16th. So.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, Nasser is not here. He had to depart for a 1 p.m. meeting. Is there anybody on the elections committee that wants to provide an update? Brian, your hand is raised.
Yeah, just real quick. I also forgot. I'm thrilled about Ellen announcing the George Peter Award making a comeback. I really think that's a great award for the community, and I am glad it's coming back.
Thank you. Anybody on the elections committee with an update? Ellen?
I can just say really briefly, I don't have detailed notes, but we did meet. I think that happened since our last general EA meeting. So there probably wasn't an update last time, unless my time scale is messed up in my brain, but we did meet and we had like a very lively and detailed conversation about kind of the direction of the role of the elections committee and the direction that we want to move in. And I think in general, was a really positive meeting and a lot of engagement, and we're looking forward to getting things rolling. And that's like super general and vague, I know, but it was a good meeting, the end.
Thank you. So that completes committee reports, unless anybody has any questions. It is 1:39. Can I get a motion to maybe either end this or extend this meeting?
Motion to adjourn.
Yeah. Motion to adjourn. Do I get a second? Ellen, is there any dissent? Seeing no dissent, I'm going to, this has been a unanimous vote to end this meeting right now at 1:39. So thank you all for coming to our EA meeting and for being engaged in this. Thank you all.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.